Hi, welcome to Lab Medicine's podcast. Today we're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Wohl, and he's going to tell us a little bit about laboratory safety.
Hi, I'm Jeff Wohl. I'm a third-year resident at University of California, San Francisco in pathology and laboratory medicine. And so I'll be discussing a recent QA publication by Agarwal et al. In the fall 2012 issue of Lab Medicine, which was entitled A Trend Analysis of Quality Indicators of Patient Safety in the Clinical Laboratory Over 21 Months. So just to give a little background, in 2004, the WHO launched a patient safety program in response to a World Health Assembly resolution that the WHO and the member states should pay closest attention to the problem of patient safety and to establish and strengthen science-based systems necessary for improving patient safety and the quality of healthcare. And so the goal of the WHO patient safety program is that every patient receive safe healthcare every time, everywhere, and really echoes the Hippocratic Oath. And a lot of the WHO issues are for third world problems, and in fact, healthcare-associated infections are 20 times more likely in developing countries than in the first world. But it is estimated that in the first world, as many as 1 in 10 patients is harmed while receiving hospital care. And so the WHO has developed some patient safety program associated curricula. Some highlights would include communicating effectively, identifying, preventing, and managing adverse events and near misses, basically continued learning, and using evidence and information to improve our patient management and patient care, working safely, being ethical. And then some specific issues which would be familiar to people working in hospitals, preventing wrong site, wrong procedure, wrong patient treatment, medication safety, and infection control. So that might sort of mimic what people are used to talking about patient safety, hand hygiene, reducing nosocomial infection, surgical errors and timeouts. Those are all things that happen on the wards in the operating room, but certainly the clinical lab isn't immune. So when we talk about quality control, proficiency testing, detailed standard operating procedures, those are all familiar to us, and those, of course, help prevent errors and improve patient safety by way of improving laboratory data output. But pre- and post-analytic issues are also important sources of threats to patient safety, and your patient and blood banks, of course, have worried about wrong patient transfusions for a long time, but the rest of the clinical labs clearly have a role to play in reducing pre- and post-analytic errors. And it's been estimated that about two-thirds of clinical decisions about admissions, medications, discharges, are based on laboratory test results. And the International Organization for Standardization, the ISO, defines a laboratory error as, quote, a defect occurring in any part of the laboratory cycle from ordering tests to reporting results and appropriately interpreting and interacting on those. Well, that's pretty broad. That's sort of daunting because based on that rule, we're supposed to be responsible for when the clinician is ordering the right test and then interpreting it correctly, and those are generally outside of our direct control. But I'll talk about how we can improve those areas as well, even though those are areas that are more difficult to get to. I'll just say for things that occur in the lab, Carraro and Plebani in Clinical Chemistry 2007, two prospective studies that they sort of put head-to-head that they'd done at different times in their own lab. And basically for the pre-analytic, analytic, and post-analytic error rate in their lab was 0.31 to 0.47%. So pretty low, but that's at one university hospital in Italy between 1996 and 2007. So pretty low, but clearly some things that can be improved. The College of American Pathology has the following patient safety goals. There's 8 of them, but I'll sort of go over them quickly. Ensure correct patient and sample identification. That's something that we're always aware of every time we accession a sample. Ensure verification and communication of lab results requiring action on the part of treating clinicians. So those results or panic values, we don't like to use that term, but those are the things we want to get out quickly to the clinicians, and we're very aware of those. And then some other things, ensure the identification, communication, and correction of errors. So those are things like establishing a safety culture, which I'll get to, that the patient safety should always be at the heart of what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. To just talk about some basic pre- and post-analytic areas that we're probably aware of, in terms of pre-analytic test ordering, that's something that might be a little harder to get to if make sure that our clinicians are ordering the right tests. Sample labeling, that's something that phlebotomy and nursing and the lab are well attuned to. Sample handling, making sure if a particular test has a particular way it needs to be handled, that we're doing that correctly. And post-analytic areas, result verification, transmission of results from the lab information system to the EMR, and then finally clinician interpretation of results, which is always a hard area. But workers in sort of the lab quality arena speak about the total testing process, and so laboratories really have to work across the department boundaries for the clinical services, provide leadership in the area of patient safety. And given the commitment of the clinical lab to quality assurance and standard operating procedures, we're really in a position to be exemplars and leaders of that. And there's many clinical lab workers who have been pushing us to be more out in front on this issue. So in sort of a holistic way, you know, what should the clinical labs be aiming for? I guess, you know, one way to put it is that we want to provide error-free services in a timely and clinician-friendly manner. But that's sort of more holistic. It's difficult to measure. And if you want to do studies, you need specific quantifiable metrics. And that's how we get into something we'll talk about today, a quality indicator. Quality indicator is, you know, something we probably thought about in the lab generally, but it's defined in a very precise way so that it's easier to study. So it's an evidence-based tool that allows quantification of a quality by comparing it to an objective criterion, such as analytical performance or an efficiency target. And so quality indicators are used as part of a broader quality management system to quantifiably monitor performance and progress. And ideally, they'd adhere to one of the Institute of Medicine domains of healthcare, patient safety, effectiveness, equity, patient-centeredness, timeliness, and efficiency. So another agency, the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, has 29 published quality indicators for patient safety. And these are things that have been validated that they're sort of encouraging people to use if they want to set up a patient safety study. And a lot of these are, once again, things that don't necessarily apply to clinical labs, like operative events such as anesthesia complications, retained foreign bodies, postoperative complications like infections, bleeding, clots, surgical dehiscence, other hospital complications such as catheter-related infections, pressure ulcers. But, you know, there are things that directly apply to us, such as the transfusion reaction rate is a validated quality indicator. And those are all out there on the web for people to look at. You know, what about other quality indicators unique to lab medicine? All we have so far is transfusion reaction rate, and a lot of that is sort of patient-dependent. As long as we give them the right blood, a lot of times patients have reaction rates no matter what we do. So what about things that we can work on day-to-day in laboratory medicine? So an important review in 2009, American Journal of Clinical Pathology by Shahangian and Snyder, evaluated laboratory medicine quality indicators, people at clinical labs had published on in the literature. And so the ones they identified were, so inside the lab were turnaround time, quality control and assay correlation of variance, proficiency testing performance, and then outside the lab was appropriate test ordering, specimen labeling, specimen adequacy, handling and rejection, blood culture contamination, patient satisfaction with phlebotomy, critical value reporting, and clinician satisfaction with lab services. So this review in 2009 found that none of these quality indicators that people in the clinical labs had published on in the literature really satisfied AHRQ, that Association for Healthcare Research and Quality, the qualities that they wanted to make a really statistically valid quality indicator, which was importance, scientific soundness, and feasibility of measure. This review in AJCP found that sort of what we've been publishing on calling quality indicators weren't as great as they really should be. But really, the lack of evidence base was generally due to a lack of quality studies, so inconsistent definition across the literature, poorly designed studies, rather than necessarily having negative studies that these didn't correlate with patient outcomes at all. It's just that the studies weren't particularly well set up to prove that. An exception to that is in Archives of Pathology and Lab Medicine, the Jones et al. CAP-Q probe studies that have shown some things that we think are quality indicators not having any measurable benefit for patient outcomes, and that's such as things like prospectively monitoring specimen rejection didn't necessarily result in the wards providing us with better labeled specimens. That's a little disappointing. So to move on to this paper, the Agarwal et al. Paper that was recently published in Lab Medicine. So this is a group from Delhi in India, and they prospectively analyzed chemistry and hematology results at their institute, which is the Institute of Human Behavior and Allied Sciences, which is a tertiary care institute, and predominantly treating neuropsychiatric patients. And they looked at all their data from January 2010 through September 2011 for errors in the pre- and post-analytic phase. Now, notably, they didn't look at their analytic error. The study overlapped with three patient safety initiatives, and that was sort of the crux of their paper, was looking at how their quality indicators varied and improved over the course of this amount of time while they had some interventions to try to improve patient safety. So the paper focuses on the following quality indicators: frequency of requisition form errors, so whether be they incomplete or incorrect, their sample rejection rate, and their critical and urgent sample reporting, and that would be a failure if it took more than 30 minutes to report, and the trend of those indicators over time. So they had more than 75,000 samples, and 60% were from inpatients. Their error rate was 115 per 1,000 tests, so that's about 11%. And incomplete requisition forms and rejected specimens really dominated those errors. They were 63 and 34% respectively. Now, the thing to note is that this institute was using paper requisitions, and that's something that's quite different than what most U.S. institutions would be experiencing, and it's something I'll discuss at the end. So the three interventions that this group put out there to try to improve patient safety, the first one being a lab event reporting system. So if there was an error, something wasn't going right, instead of sort of having that lab worker remember that and try to bring it up to their supervisor, they were going to write that in a logbook and really record it so each one could be acted on in a routine fashion. Number two, they had training for the lab workers and for the nursing staff for requisition form preparation and phlebotomy standard operating procedure. And number three was they introduced evacuated tubes, which is another thing that for U.S. workers, we've been using those for some time, but in the third and second world, it's something that they might not have access to. In terms of those interventions, only after intervention number two, which was nursing and lab training, did the requisition form completion improve appreciably. And only after intervention number three, which is the use of evacuated tubes, did the sample rejection improve appreciably. So people might be trying to do their best, but if you don't have the evacuated tubes, you make sure that you're getting the right amount of blood each time without very dedicated, making sure that, you know, filling it to the right height and, you know, just let the evacuated tube do that for you. That's going to help you improve your phlebotomy practice a great deal, and that's in fact what they saw. And, you know, they were able to actually improve the critical value reporting as well quite appreciably. So they actually eliminated critical value reporting errors, or failures, I should say, for more than a year, and that was after their second intervention. And once again, that was nursing and lab staff training on requisition form preparation. So presumably getting that correct provider information on there helped get those critical values out. So particular issues faced by the author's institution, you know, the use of paper requisitions, they actually lacked a lab information system. Everything was on paper. And, you know, as I said, the only recent adoption of evacuated sample tubes for phlebotomy. So they were able to appreciably improve their quality indicators, and they were overcoming a lot of problems and institutional issues that, you know, might be something that in the U.S. we don't think about on a day-to-day basis. But for some areas of critique on the papers, you know, they showed improvements in pre- and post-analytical phase. But, of course, you know, things can always slip through the lab's fingers that we might not necessarily be able to identify as errors. You can still have wrong patient testing events without obvious defects in the requisition or tube labeling. If both the tube label and the requisition are wrong, and it's a different patient's blood in the tube, then you're never going to be able to notice that. And then, of course, improper test ordering and results interpretation are removed from the laboratory walls. It's going to be hard for us to know about that. And then another issue is, while quick reporting of critical values is important, the most common cause of post-analytic error is clinician misinterpretation, and that was actually from a Plaboni paper in Clinical Chemistry and Lab Medicine 2006. And so continuing medical education outreach is really important. It's something that the medical staff of the clinical lab should really be out there on the front line trying to, you know, go to grand rounds, teach medical students and residents and continuing trainees about, you know, how you can best use lab services and interpret the data you're going to get. Number three, given the number of errors due to the incompletely filled out and illegible requisitions that they got at this New Delhi institution, you know, this might be pretty removed from what we have in the U.S., where electronic order entry is becoming the norm due to meaningful use requirements. So, you know, we might still have problems occasionally with, you know, how are we going to handle this outlying clinic that sends us the occasional paper requisition, but, you know, this is what this institution was dealing with on a daily basis. You know, greater than 75,000 samples were totally paper. So that's a struggle that thankfully a lot of U.S. institutions are getting away from. And number four, while incomplete requisitions were flagged, as we all remember with paper requisitions, the staff up front in the lab has to make sure that only the tests that are checked are ordered and not order any extra tests, even when there's stray marks all over the place or they're writing labs down that don't make a whole lot of sense. So the proper performance of only ordered tests on the requisitions, they didn't analyze that in this paper, and that's something that I think would have been very interesting. I've seen these, you know, these requisitions that it's hard to know what really they want, what they don't want. Number five, you know, the laboratory's proficiency testing performance, the QC failure rates, the assay coefficient of variance weren't reported. So we're really just dealing with the pre- and post-analytic errors, which is, of course, important, but sometimes it's nice to compare those to what the analytical error rate is as well. And lastly, you know, when they said that they really improved their critical value reporting, they certainly did, but what was sort of unique and I was sort of surprised is that they were allowed to report their critical values to nursing staff. And that's certainly different than the institutions I've worked at, and I think that's different than in a lot of U.S. institutions, but I only have experience at certain hospitals, so I know that you know, it'd be very nice to call up to the wards and speak to the nurse staffing that patient, but a lot of times you're trying to reach a clinician who might be off for the day and you're trying to find the on-call, and that always is going to drag out that critical value reporting. So those are some particular areas of critique that, you know, where this paper, you know, we should think about things that maybe weren't talked about in the paper, some struggles that they had that were different than what we have, thankfully, and, you know, how a U.S. study of this sort of trying to improve quality indicators in the clinical lab might be different in a U.S.-based study. And so, you know, sort of as a general discussion, how can we identify and use better lab quality indicators to really best correlate with patient outcomes? Because, you know, we can study things in the lab, but what we really are trying to get to is how does that correlate with patient outcomes and improving patient care on the wards. So in that 2009 study in AJCP by Shahanjian and Snyder, they called for bringing together multiple stakeholders to develop standardized definitions and prospective data collection to provide better quality indicators for clinical labs. And in fact, that happened in 2011. The International Federation of Clinical Chemistry and Lab Medicine, IFCC, they have a working group on laboratory errors and patient safety that developed a series of quality indicators specifically designed for clinical labs and had suggested goals. And this was in Clinical Chemistry and Lab Medicine in 2011, Ciacovelli. And so just a sampling of what they recommended for pre-analytical quality specifications, percent of requests without physician identification over the total number of requests. And that would provide you sort of an ongoing number that you're keeping an eye on. And, you know, similar for all of these, percent unintelligible requests versus total number of requests, percent samples with insufficient sample volume versus the total number of samples, percent samples clotted in the hematology lab versus the total number of samples with anticoagulant. So that's just a sampling of the pre-analytical, and some in the post-analytical would be percent reports delivered outside the specified time versus the total number of reports, percent critical values communicated versus the total number of critical values to communicate, and the average time to communicate the critical values in minutes. And that was in Annals of Lab Medicine in 2012 by Hawkins. The IFCC really has a great website set up. They even have a web-based database set up for individual labs who want to participate. They can collect their lab error data based on these quality indicators and upload that data, kind of be able to track how they're doing, correlate how they're doing with peer institutions, compare and assess that, and of course it's a great mine of data for potential studies. The UK also has sort of a separate effort in a similar vein. Julian Barth in 2012 in Annals of Clinical Biochemistry identified 10 quality indicators that are agreed upon by local UK laboratorians and clinicians, and included sort of similar areas: communication of critical results, comprehensive education to all users, and adequate quality assurance for point-of-care testing. And they actually went a little further and said laboratories should ensure their tests are used to national standards, that they have clinical utility and are calibrated to national standards and have long-term stability for chronic disease management, that laboratories should have error logs, demonstrate evidence of measures introduced to reduce chances of similar future errors, and sort of most boldly, laboratories should make a formal scientific evaluation of analytical quality based on proficiency testing and based on, you know, when we validate a test. But they're actually getting out towards, should we look at clinical outcomes and how this test correlates with the gold standard, which is something that's happening with the patient. So that was a pretty bold publication last year in 2012. Truly valuable studies on lab errors and patient safety will include important feedback from the clinical services. And I think that's where Barth et al. Were sort of getting at, that, you know, we can't just be in the lab. We have to think about laboratory quality and patient safety, you know, holistically, and how our data is going to influence patient care. And that's why ideally we would do our validation to include how that actually reflects on the patient instead of correlating it to a proficiency testing sample that might be getting away from what the real patient sample is going to be like. And one final thing I want to mention is, are pre- and post-analytical errors really to blame for most lab-associated errors? And that's certainly what we're taught, and I think that that's what most people would assume. And there is certainly a lot of data that would suggest that. I think it really is the case. Boone et al. In 1993 in Clinical Chemistry associated 93% of lab testing errors to pre- and post-analytical phase. Benigni in 2002, also in Clinical Chemistry, associated 68 to 87% of lab testing errors to the pre- and post-analytic phase. But one thing to note is that this one paper, Goldschmidt and Lent in 1995, estimated that 75% of erroneous lab results would be within the reference range, which is probably what we'd expect, and therefore wouldn't be detected. And then in 2006, an AJCP paper by Westgaard and Westgaard showed that CLIA proficiency testing rules generate only about 2 to 3 sigma quality results. And, you know, obviously we're all aiming at 6 sigma, so that's a bit of a letdown. And in fact, the Westgaard blog from June 2012 showed that the sigma metrics were a lot worse in the analytic phase of lab analysis in this recent study out of the Padua, Italy lab than they were for the pre-analytical phase. One thing to keep in mind was that Padua lab could improve their sigma metrics simply by performing the internal quality control per their protocol and participating in proficiency testing, and they were sort of losing points because they weren't doing those things that we all know that we need to, but maybe they didn't get to it in time or had a couple QC rounds that they weren't able to correct before the results got out. And then finally, one other thing that we should think about for patient safety that we might miss and wouldn't be able to identify prospectively is interfering substances and immunoassays. Immunoassays are getting better and better, but there still are, we might get a result and not have no way to tell if we hadn't seen this patient before, hadn't done that same test on them before, we wouldn't be able to tell that this data is wildly out of whack because those immunoassay interfering substances can really be insidious and be in there and affect patient care without our knowledge. So those are some other sort of general things to think about in terms of patient safety, things that should be on our mind that might not necessarily, throw up red flags, things that we sort of need to be proactive about. So, I'd just like to leave you with, I thought that this was a very interesting paper to sort of get us thinking about patient safety in the clinical labs, and that clinical labs need to remember that our work is patient-oriented, that patient safety and clinical effectiveness aren't just concerns of strictly of the wards, but should concern all of us that are involved in patient care and testing. And, we should certainly be very proud of our high standards in the clinical labs, and it does sort of make us unique and sort of, we should be out in front championing patient safety. But, we all need to be aware that all of us make mistakes, and therefore being vigilant for errors, having that patient's safety culture is, I think, the best way that we're going to improve our performance and therefore the patient safety in the future. So thank you very much for listening. I appreciated having the chance to speak with you.